My name is Harrison Wheeler, and this is the Technically Speaking Podcast. I sit down with BIPOC designers, entrepreneurs, and technologists. We discuss careers, triumphs, and their resilience, and the why behind their decisions. Before we get started with the show, I just wanted to plug our Patreon. If you like what you're listening to and you want to support the podcast, for as low as $3, you can contribute monthly to help support the production of the show. You can contribute today by heading over to patreon.com/technicallyspeakinghw. I'll also include the link in the show notes. My guest today is Christy Tillman, design extraordinaire and director of design at Netflix. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Harrison.
How are things going for you? How's the morning treating you?
It's super busy. So we're in the middle of Q3 and Q4 planning, but it's also review time, comp planning time. So lots of moving parts going on. So pretty busy, but I'm glad to be here talking to you. A nice little dip in my normal routine.
Yeah. Thank you for taking the time. And yeah, I feel that it is that time of the year for, at least in our world, like annual reviews and folks getting back from vacation. Fortunately, you've got some vacation plans, so that's good.
Yes.
Yeah. But can't wait to really touch on some of the things that, you know, you do as a director, because I know listeners are always curious about that. We always have guests from a number of different fields and different parts of their career. So it's always great to see what's it like a little bit further up the ladder, if you will. We'll touch on that. But before, we'll do some icebreakers to get the conversation started. And one thing that I always like to start out with the guests, I always like to ask them, what is something that you're currently obsessed with?
Oh, that's a good question. I think right now I'm obsessed with organizational design. I just started a new role at Netflix where I have my scope of my remit has gotten a lot larger. I've taken over a larger organization, and I've been thinking a lot about how we do our work. And this is my first time leading an organization of this size. And so I've been reading a lot of books on organizational design. And then there's also Peter Mehl's blog about organizational design. So I've been like moving chess pieces in my head for the last few weeks and thinking about how we do our work. So from a work perspective, that's like top of mind for me. And then I think in a personal perspective, I've been obsessed with like Web3. I've been really digging in and spending a lot of time in Web3 community, then learning about NFTs and DeFi and stuff like that. And so I have spent an extraordinary amount of time learning about those things and trying to understand what design's role might be in shaping that space.
Yeah.
Is that space going to even persist beyond the space that we're in now? And was really understanding the player and how it all works. So
yeah,
those have been my kind of two obsessions lately.
Yeah. I have two questions from that. So first one, how big is your organization?
It's a mid-double digit number.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Is that the scope? How do you perceive that? Was that like a, oh my gosh, I'm so excited? Is it like, ooh, I don't know if I'm ready for that? Take me through like your thinking there.
So it made me nervous initially because I started Netflix in January. And so I had not been at Netflix very long before my boss approached me and said, hey, I think this thing is going to happen and think about what this new role might be if you consider it. And he gave me a couple of options about whether I want to take it. And then if I did, like when. And so we had some of those discussions. And in the end, I was pretty excited. Honestly, I just really like working at Netflix. Oh, this is like a Netflix plug, but I really like working at Netflix. And I love the people that I work with. So I was excited that I get the opportunity to learn. And Steve, in particular, my boss, is really, really good. Yeah. And so I feel like I'm in a really good place where I've been set up for a lot of success to run this organization. So I felt nervous about it, but then it will be a challenge, but I can obviously do this. And I had the confidence of some other folks as we were thinking about talking through the planning. And I'm learning I'm on all cylinders in terms of learning.
No.
The thing that you'll figure out in your career as you go through is each company or each experience just has its own scope. So if you look at my LinkedIn, you'll see director, but all of my director experiences have been quite different in terms of scope, possibility. So I think less about title and more about what I'm going to learn.
Mm.
And so for me at this point in my career, so I went to business school before I went to design school. So if you listen to any other podcasts that I've done, you hear me talk about that. And so it was funny because I hated business and that's the reason I dropped out. I'm now that I'm a grown adult, I'm not like, man, I really wanted a more business-centric role. Mm. So one of the things that I get to do at Netflix, like I think my role is more of a GM than sure. it is of a like product design or even like design director in the classic sense. For example, at Slack, my design director role is very much in the craft of it, right? Like I rolled up my sleeves, I was doing crits, I was literally directing the designers. And at Netflix, my role is completely different. It's much more of a business strategy, product perspective role, where I think more about how do we run this organization and less about the fundamentals of design. And to me, that's a really interesting place to be in my career. Because honestly, I'm always thinking about my next move regardless. So I think in my next role, I really want to leave design. And so I feel like this role is setting me up to be able to do that. Because I'll be able to tell a really strong story about operations, running a significant budget, running a significant size team with multi layers. Yeah. And I can talk to that and how we impacted the business versus, oh, here's my portfolio of nice buttons. And so it just has different implications. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I love that. We're thinking about design from a business perspective, which isn't, I will say that there's not really too much out there that really speaks to that. But it also shows the evolution of the role from a business sense where people can understand the impact ultimately in an organization. I think I also love to hear that you're supported as well to be on that learning journey by your peers and obviously by the leaders in the organization. The second question I was going to ask, a part of sort of the obsession piece is, and you're going to listen to this later and you're going to be like, what was I talking about? How would you define Web3 on August of 2022?
Okay, so funny enough, I never listen to my podcast, so I will never listen to this podcast. I've never listened to any podcast I've done. So I, honestly, when I do them, I don't know. After I say it, it's out in the air. How would I describe Web3? Is a Wild West. It's an amalgamation of a lot of different things. So they're like altcoins, and they're like the more stable coins. That, you know, BTC, Bitcoin. Bitcoin isn't technically part of Web3. But then there's Ethereum and Solana, right? And then you have NFTs. And then you have this metaverse thing. So I think Web3 is really just a marketing term for this evolution in technology that's happening. But it's a bunch of different stuff. And so I think one of the things about participating in it is that you start to be able to peel back the layers from the either the marketing perspective or the anti-Web3 perspective, which tends to lump a bunch of different stuff together. Like even NFTs have many varieties. Like they're collectibles. There are like social passes, there are links to merchandise, right? There are so many different things happening in the space that is not just all one thing. Right. And so I think there's probably something for everybody. So the downsides are, I feel like there's too much scamming. Like you can't, like you have to really have an eagle eye to be able to understand what's real and what's not. And because it kind of lives on the decentralized principle, right? Like the custody of your high valued assets, whether they're coins that are worth something or NFTs that are worth something, are up to you. And so that presents a lot of problems that makes you very hackable. But people know that you like are in possession of these things. And because it's on the blockchain, everyone can see what's in your wallets, right? There's a lot of room for design to come in and help clean up from a UX perspective, from a safety perspective. Obviously, there needs to be some security stuff happening in there as well. But I just think it's interesting for me and from a design perspective, there's like the product design perspective of like, how do we make wallets more secure? How do we make minting more secure? How do we make the experience much more, because it really hacky. Like even buy an NFT, you got to go to this exchange, get these coins, move to your wallet. Then exactly. So like, how do we make that user experience better? And then I think there are interesting brand things that are happening too, like the visual languages that are developing around some of the projects and communities and the ability to explore. And what does it mean to redefine visual language for a company? Like in your brand book, like what memes might you own? What memes might be germane to your brand? So starting to ask those questions, like what does a Web3 brand book look like? I think there's just so much territory there.
Yeah.
Curious people will just have a really good time asking themselves those questions. And then if you want to dive into it, then there's plenty of opportunity to go in and start to create best practices.
Yeah. Exciting times.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the jury's still out on use cases and the ability to go mainstream. And maybe it's based off the niche. I don't know. Yeah. But I'm just like in it for the experiments.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Next question. What is currently on your playlist?
Oh my God. Okay. Okay, so I have a lot to talk about here. I have a playlist called Country Bops that has Conway Twitty, Loretta Lynn. I've been listening to that a lot lately. I've been listening to Beyonce's new album, Renaissance. I think Cuff It is probably my favorite song on there. Meg Thee Stallion just dropped a new album, Trauma Zine, that I've been listening to. Yeah. And then Kendrick Lamar. And I was publicly hating on Kendrick's new album when it first came out. And then I watched the Louis Vuitton men's show that he did with my alma mater's marching band. And I don't know, like, maybe the nostalgia of being in college, but that totally turned me around on his album. And I've been listening to it ever since. And even listening to that specific soundtrack from that show, it's just really good. And you chose to totally watch it. Kendrick is like really sitting down rapping a fashion show. I don't know if you saw him, but it's really good. And then the other one I'm listening to a lot still is Tyler the Creator, which is one of my favorite artists. Listening to Call Me When You Get Lost.
Which album?
Call Me When You Get Lost. I'm wearing that one out. I love it.
Yeah. How did you get the name for the playlist? You call it Country Bops?
Yeah. I don't know. I like Mary playlists. So I just have, like Ignorant Square, Country Bops, Driving Down the Highway, Songs About Atlanta. I don't know. I like naming playlists. So all my playlists have interesting names.
Yeah. I also love how when you can attach a song to or music to visuals, it can change the experience.
It really does.
Yeah. And what's your alma mater?
Florida A&M University.
Okay. All right. So the marching band. So it's a historically Black college, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Marching 100. Yeah. They played at the Louis Vuitton's men fashion show that just went. The performance is amazing.
Yeah. We'll include a link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
All right. Cool. One last. This might be controversial. Okay. So what is something problematic about the design industry that is worth turning around?
Oh, man. What's worth turning around? Do you mean like worth addressing?
Yeah. And changing. Yes.
Okay. There are two things.
Yeah.
The obvious one is I still think the design industry does not do a good job of reflecting the people that we make things for, and that there's still this codified class of people that like are too distant from the rest of the global population to be making things in private companies. So I still think that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
I don't even want to say the D word because I'm tired of it, but you know what I'm talking about. to me, it's not just about, let's diversify for the sake of like having more Black people or more queer people. It's not for the sake of representation. It's really about making products better. And then there's this huge gap of products that should exist that don't get made just because the mind share and the capital don't go to the people that could make them. So that's still a problem that's worth addressing and turning around. I think the other big problem, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, is I think that product design is stuck in how to operate within a business. We still don't fundamentally understand how to build relationships, how to make impact. We're still having the "do we have a seat at the table" question, right? That same stale conversation has not progressed.
10 years going, 10+ years going.
Exactly, we're still having that same stale conversation, and designers are still not being prepared educationally to be business people that build software within companies. And so I think that's something we need to, like, as an industry, contend with. What are the implications? We still instill in people almost ethos that are completely contrary to business.
Right.
Like we're in businesses fighting to do the opposite thing of the business just because we feel like we have this perspective on product design. And I think we need, as an industry, need to reckon with that and deflate the bubble and just come to some hard conclusions about what it means to be a capitalist tool in a business and give up the art fight of product design. And I know that's controversial, but...
No. That's real talk. No, it's real talk, right? Yeah. I think a lot... I will say this. I think a lot of perspectives that I have seen get coded in being user-centered and being the hero for the people when you're working for a business that ultimately just trying to drive money, and that revenue is tied to your pay.
I think that's a good example. There's a really So not that we want to put out crappy software, that's not what we're saying. But I do think that designers need to contend with what's good enough. Like we will say, oh, we should be bringing the best idea. And the business is asking for the most efficient idea that works. And there's a delta between those two things. And I think that's where the reckoning happens about what our job actually is, right? So I think designers are still having that fruitless fight. We're not going to win it. Give it up. Let's move on. Let's put, I really feel like I don't want to be having that conversation in 10 years.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. All right. So those are some amazing icebreakers. And I love that last question because that could be like a whole series in itself. But maybe let's get to let the listeners know a little bit about. So Chrissy, now let's tell the listeners a little bit about your journey in design and how that started and where you're at now.
Cool. So my journey in design is long and windy. So I'll skip like the other part and just say I went through a lot of education institutions and decided that none of it was for me. And then I ended up going to design school and then interning at some great places and really getting a lot of experience in design school. One of the good things about going to design school a little bit later than most like 18-year-olds is that you really know why you're there. So you can really like buckle down and focus and be in the studio. So I was able to get some great internships and leave with the, at that time, this was back when you built a portfolio in one of those big black totes and you like put it on white gloves and pull your stuff out.
Big thing.
And even the digital projects you made were like printouts that you mounted.
Printed out. Print on the poster board.
Yes, it mounted. So I was able to leave school with one of those portfolios. It was around the recession of 2008. Even my last internship got canceled. And then I kind of went through a journey through the footwear industry because I did most of my internships at design school in the footwear industry. So I naturally had connections there. And then I left the footwear industry and then spent time at IDEO. And that was a really pivotal point for me at that time. IDEO was the place to be. And it's where I got really exposed to the process of design and design's ability to impact business and industry. When you work at a consultancy, you get to see problems at all sorts of altitudes. And then you also get to work with so many different clients that you get to see design happen really fast. And that was really good for me. So I always, when young people ask me, should I go to a consultancy or agency or should I go in-house? I almost feel like designers at some point should definitely get the agency consultancy experience, especially when you're new.
Yeah.
Because what happens is you get to see a bunch of different problems versus solving one company's problem. So that was really good for me. And I ended up working on a venture design project at IDEO called Society of Grownups, where MassMutual said, hey, we sell life-term policy that millennials aren't buying our insurance. What can we do? And so we spent 3 years working on this project, ended up being a business that spun out of IDEO. And I actually went to work on the business at IDEO. Then I left IDEO to work on the business once it spun out. Built a design and brand, built a product, excuse me, product and brand team there, continued that work. And then that kind of firmly put me into the tech space from strictly design to tech. And so that was really interesting. I started working with engineering closely. And that was really good for me too, because the downside to working in a consultancy like IDEO is you work on a lot of blue sky initiatives, a lot of 0-to-1 initiatives, and you don't ship a lot of things. And there's a lot that's said about shipping things and understanding data on the back end and that. And so I was like, I really want to see something through. So that's when I lost.
Yeah.
And then Twitter, right? Twitter was always a big part of my life. And I think it was Dio that I met on Twitter, he was at Slack at the time, and we were just chit-chatting on Twitter kind of like regularly. And he reached out to me and he was like, hey, I'm at Slack. I'd love to talk to you about it. And he and I chit-chatted. And then the story has been a while now. He and I chit-chatted. And then I met someone else on like a design Slack. Oh, yeah. I met my then soon-to-be boss in a design, like one of the design Slacks.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, I'm going to Slack. Like, so-and-so told me they've been talking to you. When I get there, let me see what it looks like. And then I'll reach out to you. And see how the open roles. And so I think it's been like a year and a half talking to the guy that's left. Like a couple of roles came up. They weren't the right fit for me.
Yeah.
And then one day a role opened up and they're like, hey, I think this is perfect for you. It was a brand role. It was building the first brand design team at Slack. Joshua called me like, hey, I got this role. We're going to be hiring a director of communication design. Do you want to do this? I was like, hell yeah. I think it was like a week between the time he called me and the time I flew out to San Francisco and interviewed.
Wow.
It was very quick because I was like scrambling to get my portfolio together. So listeners, always be ready.
I was going to say, what's the difference between a role that comes your way where you're like, maybe, and like the hell yeah.
Yeah. So for me on that one, when I was working firmly in design, I spent a lot of time on tech Twitter. And there was a lot of things I didn't like about technology culture. And so I was very hesitant about going to a strict tech company, especially a Silicon Valley tech company, because I don't know what the age range of your listeners are, but the 2008, the 2010 tech Twitter is like legendary. Like it was like the age of email startups and YC was like the king, right? I was thought leading and it was like, everyone move out to Silicon Valley. You get rich. Like it was just a whole scene, right? Like it was booming. The engine was booming and startup culture really came into mainstream to regular people on Twitter at that time, because most people didn't have access or a view into that culture, right? Before it became mainstream on social media. So that was a really interesting time. And it was like, I was like, man, do I want to like move to Silicon Valley and like go to some company where they like have dogs roaming around and they're playing ping pong all day? It just didn't. So I was really hesitant about that. And I was in Boston, right? I was on the East Coast. And so I was like, okay, I was like, if I'm going to go out there, it has to be for the role that like really moves me, right? And so it had to be very obvious. And I had other opportunities. It was funny because I was thinking about it this morning. I dodged a bunch of like bullets. Like I got other offers because at that time, a lot of people were leaving IDEO for startups and they were like bringing alumni along. There was always this like holes of opportunities that I could have taken that would have diverted my career any other way. I think I've done a good job, and I don't even credit myself for this. I honestly just think it's pure luck of knowing which opportunities to take and which ones not to take. So I went out to San Francisco. I interviewed. It was amazing. I was like, wow, this is okay. I was like, this is cool. Once I got there, I felt a lot better. Interviewed. Yeah. And then I think a couple of days later, they called me and told me I got the role. And it was like, okay, now I got to pack up and leave Boston. And I was so nervous. Don't tell them this, but I left Boston because I drove from Boston to San Francisco. Never do that.
You
make the company ship your car. I was regretting it by like day one. Day like by hour 27, I was like, fuck.
And you were only in Tennessee or something.
Right. Exactly. Like, you had to car. Exactly. And so I was supposed to leave much earlier, but I was so nervous. I left 3 days before my orientation. So I literally pulled into my hotel.
3 days.
I literally pulled into my hotel like 11 p.m. and my orientation was like at 9 the next morning. So never do that. It was a life-changing event to me. Slack is just such a special company. At that time, it was the darling in Silicon Valley and all cylinders were firing. And it was just like us against the world and hyper growth. And we were just hiring like crazy. And it was such an energetic time and such a career transforming time. I just learned so much. Also had some good, hard lessons and head bumps too. Yeah. So learned a lot, and it was life-changing moment there. So that is what got me out of San Francisco. And then from there, I was just like, oh, okay, just a series of job changes. Most recently, when Steve called me and was like, hey, have this role at Netflix. It's a mix, and you have an enterprise experience. You got marketing experience. I think this will be good for you. And so I was like, okay. I had created Made in the Future Fellowship for underrepresented designers, and Steve was one of the speakers. So I got a chance to meet him at that event and make that connection. And then so he called me a few months later. I was like, hey, I have this role, you want to take it? I was like, I was not sure, because at the time I was at Facebook and I had a director role there, but I wasn't a people manager, just like the best of both worlds, where you can lead an initiative but you don't have to manage people. So I was really hesitant about going back in and being a people manager. But the recruiting process at Netflix was so good. Steve was like, hey, talk to all the people you want to talk to. And then you tell me, like, do you want to formally interview for this role? And so I spent a couple, like, weeks, like maybe like 6 to 8 weeks, just talking to different people about the role, about the Netflix culture. And then I formally interviewed. So there's a theme there that now I'm picking up, that I'm recounting this story, that like the best jobs I've had are ones that where I took my time and like really spent time, like really being considered about it. Because with Slack, I was like, I could have jumped on roles much earlier. I just don't think they would have been the best for me. But I waited until that right role came around. It was a similar thing with Netflix. I spent a lot of time like being considered about whether I was going to take that role. And like, I really enjoy working at the company. So,
I think another thing too, like you talked about being prepared for these types of roles. And I think sometimes people get caught up in maybe some of the slower parts of their career where things might be a little bit uneventful. But all of this has happened, what, in the last 6 years or so, right?
Yeah, I mean, I started in 2016.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that transformation can happen pretty fast. I think specifically, you said like that opportunity at Slack was a big moment for you, working in such a fast-paced company with really great energy, and then also with the opportunity for you to extend yourself a bit more, and that's led to some more amazing opportunities.
Correct.
So I have one more thing I want to touch on is some of the side projects that you've worked on. Obviously, you've got an amazing sort of career, and I'd love to know, like, you've worked on like the Detroit Water Project. You've also worked on the MIT Fellowship. And high level, you don't have to tell us like about the projects, but high level, like, when you're working on personal projects, why do you give back? And then also, what are some of the things that you've learned from it and that have maybe are guiding you towards maybe something a little bit later on?
Yeah. So I feel like side projects are another avenue to create opportunity. Like, none of this is planned. No one sits down and says, I'm going to do this, and it happens exactly that way.
Yeah.
Well, I think what you can do is you can create you can expand your surface area of opportunity. So I think your imagination is this big, but the opportunity space of things that could happen to you is this big. So you can't even imagine all the possibilities. Like, you cannot literally plan out all the good things that could happen to you. But what you can do is you can increase your surface area and make yourself available to different people just via connections, via giving back. And you just never know who's going to come into your life, how it's going to materialize, what's going to happen because of it. So I don't do side projects just like to get things. That's not the case. But what they just enrich your life and give you another avenue to explore. Mm. And then the thing is, you get to control them, right? You get to do exactly what you want to do versus the things that you work on at work. And so one of the hard-won lessons that I've learned in my career is that you do not own the stuff you do at work. It is not your stuff, belongs to the company. And there has to be some level of personal detachment from it, because people get too wrapped up in the identity of where they work or what their career says they should be doing, and then maybe they're not on track or whatever, right? And all that stuff is just hot air. But you can do with your side project, you can do exactly what you want to do. You can invite who you want into your side project. Hey, do you want to meet that person? Do you want to work with that person? And make an opportunity for yourself to meet that person. Like, maybe in the future, it was like, okay, I knew I wanted to do that project. It had been bubbling in my head for 5 years before I did it. I finally got the opportunity to do it. And there's something to be said about timing too, which we could talk about in a whole other podcast. But sometimes ideas just have to rust, and then like the timing of them just work themselves out. So it was like, okay, I'm going to do this. How do I create opportunity for other people to feel like they're giving back? Who are some people I want to meet through this? Who are some people that I want to make connection with?
Yeah.
And let me invite those people into my fold and give them the opportunity to give back, and what might come of that. So I met my new boss through that. Yeah. I met another mentor through that who helped me negotiate my offer. I have a couple of friends that I text with probably a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
We're like pen pals now. And group chats. It's like, you just never know. So I think you have to give yourself an opportunity to have as many connections with people as possible if you want to have an interesting story, a colorful story. And then if you want to bust into spaces that maybe are good for you, but you just couldn't have imagined that an opportunity just availed itself. So you can't do that just like being a sole lower designer in a corner, never talking to anyone, never giving back to anyone, never making connections. People always say, how do you network? I think one of the easiest ways to network is to give other people opportunities. Mm-hmm. People want to be helped, and people want to see that you're investable and coachable. So making opportunities for other people to do things is a great way to break into other networks. So that's one of my hacks. You want, if there's someone you want to meet on Twitter, you follow them on Twitter. Man, I really want to know this person. Reach out to them and make yourself useful.
And I love how that kind of brought the Netflix journey full circle as well. So I'm going to ask you this. So as leading organizations, this is a multi-pronged question. So you can either answer each thing or it can be thematic.
Okay.
But I guess, what would be some advice that you give for emerging designers, someone mid-career, and then someone at a senior level?
So
we'd been discussing some of the concepts around business and working in an organization.
So I think for mid-career people, I think that's a really interesting point. I actually consider myself mid-career, to be honest.
Yeah.
I would be classified as senior leader just based on my proximity title to the CEO and to my VP.
Yeah.
And maybe it's one of those things where you're like upper class, where you still see yourself as middle class. So I'm totally open to saying that I'm wrong about that. I think mid-career is interesting because I think you're at an inflection point about like what you want to do. And there's just so many possibilities. So I would say mid-career, like just be, I think one of the important things that I talk about this on my Twitter a lot, especially for mid-career people, is not, and this is going to be a really like privileged sounding take, but I grew up working class too. So I don't want to caveat that. And this is not to say you should be poor, but I would not optimize for short-term money at the mid-career level. I'm not saying don't get paid, but don't make pay like the ultimate variable that you make all your decisions around. Mm. And in some places, there may be opportunities that suit themselves where the pay is just okay and you sacrifice making $50 or more to get further. So when I actually went to back to design school, I did that because I delayed my pay to go to school again. And then, like I told you earlier, I passed up a lot of other opportunities that came my way from like my IDEO alum network. You were talking to Slack much earlier. I was like, no, I'm not taking these roles. And I could have been making a lot more money. Yeah. And I didn't because it just weren't the right roles. And I feel like I'm probably caught up now to where I should be, or even have exceeded probably most of my peers.
Sure.
According to my mentor, I've exceeded most of my peers. And so I think really optimizing for what you want to do, what you want to learn, who you want to work with. I think another thing is like at companies, you're working next to your future boss or maybe your future co-founder. There are a lot of opportunities at a company that evolve beyond just like being there working and going up their ladder.
It's about
the people you work with. So I would optimize for learning, optimize for network, and increasing your surface area mid-career. And also, too, I think location. One of the things, I recently left San Francisco in November, and I'm trying to decide that was a mistake or not. I'm really reflecting on it. One of the interesting things about San Francisco in particular, and this applies to the East Coast as well, but if you're in tech, it will resonate with you, is the surface area for opportunity in San Francisco is just so dense. And it's just so hard to replicate that anywhere else. And so when you are in that space where you can dedicate a lot of time to your career and thinking about what you want to do, I think like being somewhere where there's lots of physical opportunity is important. I know we've been talking a lot about like people leaving the Bay and turning other cities into little tech hubs. That nothing wrong with the Bay. It just doesn't.
Can't move to Iowa trying to be a star in Hollywood.
Exactly. Totally. When I had my hesitation about moving from the East Coast to the Bay, I'm glad I finally got over that because I think that would have held me back if I had stayed, particularly in Boston, and not moved to San Francisco. It really optimizing for who you want to be in 10 to 15 years. So I'll say that for middle career people. For senior people, I think for senior people, it's probably about not getting too senior. So I was on a Twitter space a couple of weeks ago with Ivy, who runs like different spaces about different parts of technology roles. And she asked me, like, how do people break in who are junior? Like, how do you break into product design? I didn't have a really great answer to her. I was like, my answer to her was like, I am so far from that part of the journey that I can't even tell you. And I haven't hired anybody in a year and a half. So I'm not even sure what the resumes are looking like these days because I haven't had to look at portfolios or resumes of folks. And when I do, they're going to be senior people. They're not going to be junior people anyways. And I was like, damn, I thought about it afterwards. I'm so far removed from what it means to be like a first year or second year, third year person trying to get into product design and build a career. And I don't even know how people are breaking in beyond like special programs anymore. So I was like, man, I'm like, maybe I'm getting too senior. Like I'm getting too far away from the experience of people who are coming into this field. And so I really had to reflect on that. I got to figure out what I'm going to do about it. I don't know yet, but it was a reflection point for me about like how easy it is to lose touch.
Yeah.
It can happen very quickly. So when you acquire money, power, status of any kind, it can quickly change your perspective. And I think that's something that we have to have a lot of self-awareness about, internal checks and balances about. So maybe that's my advice for senior people. Don't get too senior.
Christy, thank you so much. This is an amazing, wide-ranging conversation. It was great to learn a bit more about you and your thought process around the work that you do as well. How can listeners find you on the internet?
They can find me at Christy T on Twitter. That's probably the best place. I know, other than LinkedIn, I don't really do other social media. Facebook is for my family only.
Yeah. I should have said the World Wide Web.
Yes. So that, you can find me at Christy T on Twitter. I tweet a lot. So that's where you can find my voice.
Awesome.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
That concludes the show. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That is a huge way to show your support, and it really helps us reach more people and grow our following. By the way, we release a new episode every 2 weeks, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram, LinkedIn, or YouTube at Technically Speaking HW. Again, thanks so much, and I'll see you next time. This has been a production of Technically Speaking Media.